session number 20144, Reel 1.
Tom Gore, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Dartmouth, Devon.
Which year was this?
The 3rd of the 5th, 25.
Did you grow up and have your schooling at Dartmouth?
Until the age of 7. Then we moved to Paignton.
What did your father do for a living?
Butcher and boiler maker. Shipyard.
Where did you go to school?
Dartmouth and Paignton.
Do you remember the names of the schools?
Dartmouth School. That's as far as I can remember. And the Paignton Tweenaway School.
How old were you when you finished your schooling?
14 years old.
So a war had just broken out?
The same year as the war. I worked for 2 months until the September, then the war broke out.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
I did, yes.
Under what circumstances?
Actually, I was in the slaughterhouse when I heard it.
How did you feel about the news?
I felt a bit thrilled because it nearly broke out before and we were more or less a bit disappointed.
Why disappointed?
Well, because of the we had heard so much about the war, 14 more, that we were more or less wanted something to happen, probably, in our life.
Did the war affect you at first?
Not too great to start with. And then I joined the Home Guard at the age of 15, nearly 16.
What was that like?
Every fourth night, we used to go down to the cliffs at Three Beaches, Paignton, and guard the cliffs and Goodwinton Sands, making contact with the regular army. The Buffs. There was a regiment of the Buffs stationed at Goodwinton, and we used to cooperate with them and guard the coast.
Any stories you've got of that period?
Only to say that the Home Guard was not the dad's army that they portray on the television. The biggest part of them was made up with young men waiting to be called up. And we done our bit. We used to work through the day, go on guard every fourth night, and work through the following day. So we used to go pictures the following night and fall asleep. I can remember a lot about the Home Guard, but I don't think anything really exciting happened. Not to that extent.
Did you think the Germans would invade?
Yes. Well, they were bombing Plymouth and Exeter. And there was a very likelihood of the Germans invading, yes. I've seen the men come back from Dunkirk. And they came by train down to this way to the empty holiday camps when I was 14.
What impression did they make on you?
Well, not very good, because we had a big map at the time where we were going to put the advances of the British Army, and obviously the Germans were taking over Europe, so it didn't make a very good impression. But they were very, very rugged soldiers.
What did you feel would happen if the Germans did invade?
Well, most of the houses had rifles then, and I think we had 3 rounds of ammunition each to start with there. We would have probably delayed them until the regular forces could have got at them. But I think we would have lost a lot because we weren't really, as I learned after, digging in was the main thing. Getting away from shelling, not rifle bullets. We really thought it was going to be rifle bullets, but I think the shelling would have got us, actually, as I learned later in life.
What do you remember happening next?
Next, I got my over the wireless. It came that all men born between certain ages would register for conscription into the regular army or regular forces. And at the age of 17, I registered for conscription. Then had my medical on the before I was 18. And then 10 days after I was 18, I was in the army, reporting to Colchester. And then it was real army stuff.
What was the training like at first?
The first 4 weeks was getting you used to it, your equipment, dental treatment, inoculations, vaccinations. And then after 4 weeks, you went on to what they called core training, which was a infantry training wing of the Dempsey Regiment. And then we'd done 10 weeks heavy training on a very strict program. We used to have our programs, our PT, our on the rifle range. And then it gradually led up to the 20-mile route march. And we were very, very good infantrymen after we finished that training.
Were you able to cope with that?
Yes, very, very well. Yes. We were all young men. And there was a selection board that was going to select you to put you in your trades at the time. And there was 30 of us in our platoon. And we all put down for different trades. And when the time come, 29 of us went to the infantry and one to the pioneers. So the selection board was nil.
How were you treated by the people in charge of the training?
Looking back, I think we were treated very well. But of course the discipline was great, really, the discipline. You were so trained to be soldiers. And the sergeant major in the RSM was to be respected. Although not appreciated.
What happened to you next?
Next we were drafted to the 12th Dempsey Battalion. We got on the train at Colchester. We didn't really know where we were going. And we ended up at Bulford Field Camp near Salisbury. And it was an airborne division. So we did all our training, airborne training. The CO had us to start with and said, the only difference between you and ordinary infantry is that you, the ordinary infantry, sometimes fights in a tight corner, but you will always fight in a tight corner. And we're being trained to fly over the Western Wall. We passed our glider passenger badge at Broys Norton, where we did glider training, or some of our glider training, which entailed going up into gliders, Horsa gliders, pulled by the old Whitley bombers. And the gliders were full up with concrete blocks to make up the weight. and six of us at a time added to the load to train the pilots. So it was pretty scary. And we also used to do the job of tail end Johnnies to tell the pilot of the Whitley when the glider was airborne. I think we'd done about 10 days training there, and it was a luxury to us infantrymen to be stationed with the RAF, because there was a great difference in the eating facilities and the canteens.
You mean the quality of food?
The quality of food, yes. One thing that I'll remember at the RAF, they had what they called a William Tell counter. And any food that was left over, they put on this William Tell counter, and anybody could help themselves to it. And of course, we were very prominent at the William Tell counter. shall I go on?
Please.
After about 3 months or so, for some reason, all the young men, the youngest of the men that were in D Company, we were the latest draft there, and we were D Company, all young men, so they used to call us the Puppy Dugs, Dug Company. And about 30 of us were sent on draft to the 6th Battalion, the Dempster Regiment, stationed in Carrickfergus, Ireland, where we'd done further training in the rain. Then as the invasion time grew near, the 6th Battalion was a training battalion. We moved down to Seaford in Essex, and so many first class shots from each company was formed into a platoon and sent as a demonstration platoon to the 2nd Army Battle School in Lamberis, where we demonstrated to all the officers from Brigadier downwards, from Brigadier to Lance Corporal, frontal attacks, Bangalore torpedoes, river crossings, right flankings, left flankings. Then that school closed down, we were sent back to battalion, and we did duties on a transit camp outside Brighton on the regimental police, keeping the invasion forces in the camp before D-Day. And one of the battalions that went through was the Cameronians, which I had never heard of before, but of which I was later to join, funny enough. And when in July we were sent on a draft, the 6th Battalion broke up, and we were the last to be drafted out from the 6th Battalion. They had sent them all over the world, virtually, the 6th Battalion. A lot of them ended up in Italy. A lot of them ended up in Anzio. But we landed up in Normandy as reinforcements. After 3 days in transit at Bayeux, just outside Bayeux, that was the second transit camp. We went to the first one, which was tents, overcrowded tents, and they prepared a meal for us. They said it would be ready in 1 hour. And the meal turned out to be a tin of steak and kidney, roughly cut in half, still in the tin, and a packet of Ard Tack biscuits and half a mug of tea. After a day there, we moved on to Bayou. The first camp was under real tents. The second transit camp was half a tent, which was the fly cover of a tent in a pit. Then after that, draft got sent to the Cameroonians. So we went to A echelon and B echelon, the Cameroonians. And we gradually left all our bullshit equipment behind. Brasso, Blanco, which we've been trained so thoroughly in. And we left our field marching order and moved into battle order. And we joined the 9th Cameroonians on a side of a hill with two knocked out tanks. And the adjutant of the Cameroonians, Major McNair, gave us a little lecture about the Cameroonians, about the Covenanters, etc., the Protestants of Scotland. And told us to keep ourselves smart and clean and try and keep a crease in our trousers, which was virtually impossible. In fact, it was impossible. And I joined Sambatoon A Company in the corner of a field, which had a Canadian officer, Canelon, I think they called it, Canelon officers, which were on loan from the Canadian Army. I think he was called Stuart. And I was in Gutford in platoon headquarters on the 2-inch mortar, which was a cushy job, really a better job than being in the sections. But of course, you had extra equipment to carry, 2-inch mortar bombs, etc., etc. We were there told again that rations would be up soon. The rations came up, and it proved that the latest draft us was not on the ration strength, so we weren't included in the meal. But luckily, I had a tin of sardines in my pack. So we had sardines and Ard Tack biscuits. You always kept Ard Tack biscuits with you, because they filled in when the meals didn't arrive. We used to keep a little assortment of Ard Tack in your big map pocket. They all got broke up, but they were all very... It was a very good source of food if you didn't have any. Go on. As nightfall fell, we dug in the first slit trench, which I was digging many. As night fell, we were ordered to get dressed, and we fell in sections and platoons, and we marched through the night. And it was a big experience because the guns were going off all around the place. The first day of action, this was. And we turned into a field and scraped a hole in the ground for the night. That was when I first appreciated my gas cape. Because the gas cape was intended for gas, but it never materialized, thank goodness. But it was a very, very useful bit of equipment, the gas cape. It was a very big cape. And you lay in the hole and cover yourself with a gas cape. That was your only covering. We went through the night with the shells falling close by, Next morning at dawn, get dressed. This great dress business, we never undressed. But it just meant putting on your equipment and picking up your rifle virtually. We moved off past a lager of tanks that were brewing up their breakfast on their little stoves. And of course, we ain't had no breakfast. But that was the least of our worries. We went through paths and woods to the top of a hill where there was infantry dug in that looked very, very weary. Just then, there was a moaning noise coming towards us. And it was my first experience of the German six-barrel mortar that they called the Mona Mini, because it made such a noise that it came towards you. Then all of a sudden, six shells landed amongst us. And then that was another experience. The shout for stretcher bearers. Stretcher bearers for the wounded. Sergeant Smith, or Sergeant, shouted for us to keep moving. So we moved on, turned left down a very high edge lane, and we came to a village. And at the end of the village was a big orchard. The company spread out in the orchard, and this was apparently the start line for the attack. We never had no briefing or anything. It was just, we were taking it as it comes. And we moved off through fields, and it was a beautiful day. It was just like Devon. Of course, it was the Buck Age country in France. We moved on in this beautiful weather, not a care in the world, I thought. Then all of a sudden it started. Shells, shells, and more shells. And the cry for stretcher bearers. We dug in a pit, what they call a slit trench. Two men to a trench. Me and my mate, John Grant. We've been together a long time, me and John. We dug in and got below ground to get at the blast of the shells. And there was a shout from the platoon commander's trench, Sergeant Smith, told me and the runner to move down the bank in front of us. That with the woods in front of us and down the bank, and report back all we seen or heard. The first thing we seen was an officer, a major, coming down the path, holding his arm with blood pouring through it, that he had been wounded in the arm. We shouted to him if he wanted help, but he never murmured a word, just carried on down the road. And then the shelling started down the lane, path. Then the shelling started again, and the shells started hitting the trees, shrapnel falling like rain. So we bored a hole in the side of the bank. And I'm not a religious man, but we said a few prayers that day. After a while, the shelling stopped, and a wounded lance corporal was handed down to us. We're told to move to the end of the lane, the path, and we find a road about 3/4 mile away. So he was wounded in the foot, this lance corporal. Why he never went to the stretcher bearers, I don't know. Perhaps they were too busy. So we toddled off down the lane with him, a very big burden. After some time, we come to a farm. And there was a load of blown up cows in the farm, which is very common in Normandy, by the way, the cows, blown up cattle. And they all used to get polluted, blown up like balloons, and smothered with flies, and stink. In the middle of these cows was a wheelbarrow. So we rescued the wheelbarrow and put our friend in, or wounded comrade, and wheeled him off down the path. Then we got the end of the path, and the shelling started again, really severe. So we clung to the side of the edge, and there were several Cameronians there from all different companies. We started digging in the side of the edge. The chap in the next trench got a bit of straton across his neck. He just put his hand to it and run up the road. I hope he reached the first aid. And around the corner was battalion headquarters with their wireless sets and commotion going on. And then the jeep come up the road with a Red Cross, loaded with wounded, two very bad stretcher cases on top, and the walking wounded clinging to the side. So we put our comrade on, and the jeep streaked up the road. We didn't know what to do next, so we just stayed there. We were out of touch with the company. Then all of a sudden, the shelling stopped. And three of our Typhoon planes circled overhead, dived into the enemy lines, firing their machine guns and rockets, causing quite a lot of trouble. And then three more and three more. And the smoke where they hit on the opposite side of the valley was very prominent. Then all of a sudden three tanks come down the road, went around the corner firing. Our own artillery opened up with the shells buzzing overhead. And the Vickers machine guns from behind us chattered away, firing over to the valley. Then after a while, a good while, it all went quiet. And things seemed to be normal. So we set off to look for A Company, or no, 7th Platoon. Just when I got around the corner, there was about six men of 7th Platoon coming up the road with their mess tins. They were going back for a meal. This must have been about, probably, well, never no watch, about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. So I joined them and we went back for a meal. And it was a breakfast at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. But that was the first day of action. So we weren't really hungry. It was must have been the night before that we had half a tin of sardines each. But we really weren't hungry then. But as the campaign went on, we learned that you had to eat when you can. Never refuse any food. Rejoined the platoon that was dug in across a narrow bridge. This was the 6th of August, by the way, which went down in the Cameroon history as Black Sunday. We went over a